Penny! Penny! Penny!
I'm ready!
Book smash!
But Arbiter friend?
Am I not the captain of this ship?
You're a wizard, Harry.
Shadow Clone Jutsu!
Mr. Messenger.
And the Billboard Music Award goes to...
Pikachu!
BTS!
Winter is coming.
Hello, Larry.
Hey, how you doing?
Bye-bye!
Hello, 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 and welcome to Let's Talk Fandoms, a podcast where we talk about all things fandom. I'm your host, Tazita Gant, and today I am finally getting the chance to sit down with a four-time indie author, story consultant, professional ghostwriter, and the founder of a new life coaching company for elderly millennials called Extraordinary Joe Coaching. Some of his books include the sci-fi romance Convergence and a Philip K. Dick-inspired novella, Red Brick. He is currently working on a futuristic war story called SD, along with a reality-bending travel adventure called Variations of Paris. We have talked heavily about storytelling and world-building together, but I am so excited to continue the conversation with all of you and with my guest today. Please welcome Jody Aberdeen.
Yay, thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited.
I'm so excited. I feel so bad because it's taken us a while to like get to this point of recording.
You've had a number of things happening since then, since we first talked. So, you know what? Everything's in its own time, right?
Exactly. But this topic itself, I think, is really exciting. A lot of the guests that I've had on the podcast and a lot of the listeners that I've been able to interact with are creating stories and creating fiction, and a big thing is a lot of them are creating fan fictions and they're creating their own stories and they're self-publishing. And I think something like this of world building is so important, and so it's just not talked about enough in the essence of like, how do you build a world and how do you create something out of nothing?
Right. Definitely. It's one of the, I think they're starting to get some attention outside of like, if you were already into writing, if you were already kind of a specialist. You know how industries, like people in an industry or in a trade or in a fandom like to talk to each other only?
Exactly.
Like that's what happens. If you were already kind of a writing junkie, you already kind of get this. But if you're just kind of a person who gets into a fandom, wants to do a fanfic, suddenly it's like, okay, well, the world's already laid out for you. You don't really think about that. But then when you go to write your own story, it's like, suddenly it's like, okay, why doesn't this make sense? Why is this so hard, really? Why can't I get to flow? The world building's really at the heart of that. And so that's really where I think now the conversation seems to be gearing towards that and more people are aware of it.
I mean, it's astonishing the amount of websites that are specifically dedicated to organizing your thoughts as a writer, especially as a new writer. And you see all these master classes about world building and creating characters and creating a plot and a story. And I think you're absolutely right. It's becoming so much more of a well-spoken and well-talked about topic that, I mean, the whole aspect of self-publishing almost kind of revolves around the career of teaching people how to create and be creative.
Yeah, 100%.
How would you define the term fandoms or fandom?
A fandom applies to so many different things outside of media, entertainment, and storytelling. I would say it's enthusiasm. It's a group of people who are enthusiasts. And I got that term, I started using that term from Anthony Bourdain, and he's been in the, you know, they're releasing that new documentary about him, and he's been all over the place recently. He defined himself as an enthusiast because it was the one word that described his deep interests and passions for particular things, not just food. He loved food, of course, right? But learning about other cultures, he loved music. He loved just getting into culture and pop culture especially, but that's kind of he loved true crime, right? He loved reading about that stuff. He had a fascination with that sort of dark underbelly of society, right?
Yeah.
And it was really a curiosity about, so using that term enthusiasm, right? It's like, I got to check this before you put it out there. Maybe do it in real time. I feel like the etymology of the word is like to be filled with light or to be filled with the energy of God or something like that, right? That's okay. Where it comes from. Something Greek.
Yeah.
About. And whatever fills you up and lights you up, right? That's really enthusiasm. And for a fan, that's how I would define a fandom. It's like you get something different from, if you've got a fandom for Harry, if you're in the Harry Potter fandom, you're in the Avatar, Last Airbender fandom, Star Wars, you know, MCU, whatever it may be, or even something totally niche that no one's ever heard of. It's whatever gives you that feeling of being filled up with like energy. It makes you feel like this is fun.
Yeah.
This is exciting. I'm willing to binge this. I'm willing to spend hundreds, not thousands of dollars that I might not even have on hand, right?
Right.
You know, thanks to the, you know, blessed be the folks at Visa, right? On this fandom, right? On this stuff, just getting posters and stuff, anything related to it. It's kind of like, it's just the side of a hobby. I mean, it is a hobby too. Like if you're a cosplayer, you're obviously, you know, taking those skills, right? And if you're a fan fiction writer, if you're a fanfic writer, you are an enthusiast, obviously. And so that's kind of how I define, that's how I would define fandom. It's a group of people that are lit up with that enthusiasm in a very specific way for very specific stories.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
And what would you say kind of your first introduction to fandoms or fandom culture or the fandom community was?
Star Wars. Like, not even, no hesitation. I was 3 years old. I grew up in the 80s. And Star Wars, Return of the Jedi had just come out on VHS, I think. I'm probably getting the years wrong. But I did see the first one. We had the VHS copy of A New Hope. And I remember back then just looking at the case. I'm a kid, okay? Like I'm not even in kindergarten yet. but I had a lot of attention from my mother. She got us very literate early on, so we were reading. We were reading at a very advanced level, all of us kids. And so, we were also very tech savvy because we had a Commodore VIC-20 computer in our house. Right. So I've had a computer since I was three, at least, right? Access to it. So it wasn't, it wasn't scary technology to me. And I knew how to use the VCR. So
perfect.
So whenever I wasn't in school, I was watching predominantly Star Wars because that was the only big one that was there. And I remember building little Legos to make my own little, I couldn't make a TIE fighter. I couldn't make an X-Wing, but I could make my own versions of those. Right.
Yes.
And, I remember having the books. There's an image from Return of the Jedi where Luke, there's a freeze frame they took from the movie where Luke has, they're starting the rescue of Han Solo where they're already at Sarlacc, right? The Sarlacc pit. And he's holding the lightsaber in a particular way, right?
Yeah.
And I remember seeing that particular, that's a freeze frame from the movie they used as the book cover.
Oh.
And I remember watching the movie in VHS saying, and trying to pause it at that one stop. It's like, see, that's where the book comes from. That's where they got it. It's from the book. It was just all these archetypes, right? That I didn't know what the word archetype was, right? But that's what was happening in my brain. And that, so Star Wars was very much my first, the OG fandom for me, right? And it's the fact that Lucas deliberately put in, you know, in a way, it's responsible for a lot of how my own life turned out later on, if I really am clear about it, because the fact that Lucas drew upon Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, so like that became my foundational archetype, right?
Yes.
That's a whole other thing I'm sure we can talk about.
We are so getting into that.
The hero's journey archetype, you know, archetypes and whatnot, almost to a T. The fact that Yoda drew on Eastern philosophies. Now, I was raised, kind of, you know, my family's from the West Indies, from Trinidad, and growing up in Canada, we were raised, you know, in a Presbyterian church, right? Like the Christian mindset. The first exposure I had to anything remotely Eastern happened in the way that he conceptualized the Force, which he drew upon from Eastern traditions. And I think, like, and then later on when I got into spiritual and New Age stuff and people are talking about the law of attraction and all these other things, right? That yeah. kind of figured into it, the Force. And these kind of laid out that kind of baseline neurology in my brain as a kid for what was to come later. And I didn't know that at the time. At the time, I just thought, this is the coolest story ever.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, definitely Star Wars, the first three. Obviously the prequels weren't even I think they were a concept, but nobody was really doing anything with it at the right. time. And it's amazing to see how it's grown since. The Mandalorian is the most recent experience I've had with it. And
phenomenal.
I need to go talk to someone about the finale, like someone professional, because I still, so that was how I discovered, you want to talk about another sub fandom, the reaction fandom, right? Isn't that right? A YouTube reactors to it. That was how I discovered them, because I watched the finale alone. I'm no spoilers if you haven't seen it. I know we're well past the statute, the reasonable statute of limitations around spoilers for The Mandalorian, but
we're also a fandom podcast.
Yes. But I relived that moment, the roller coaster
yes.
through the eyes, because I was locked down. I live alone in an apartment. If yeah. I had my friends over, we would be watching, but I couldn't do that. So okay. watching the reactors look at that scene over and over again did something, right?
It brings another level
yeah.
to watching a show that you really enjoy or a movie that you really enjoy. I used to not be a very big person who watched reaction videos. And even in the episode with my friend Nick Lanier about video games, we talked about him watching people playing video games or reacting to other people playing video games. And I remember feeling that I thought that was very odd and strange of like, if you're going to watch someone do something, just do it.
Yeah.
But more recently, and I think more recently during the actual lockdown itself, I, very similar to you, it sounds like, had a lot of that like, oh, well, I want to share this experience with someone else, but yeah. I can't. Like, I yeah. physically can't. So then I started going onto YouTube for that kind of like additional engagement. And I was finding and watching people who were reacting to some of my favorite movies. And I got really into people reacting to Rick and Morty. And it's one of my favorite shows at the moment. I mean, absolutely incredible. And I mean, you're absolutely right. Getting to relive that and watch someone else's reaction and see how it's different or similar to mine or see what they're seeing that I might have missed. Mm-hmm. It's a whole nother level to, you know, quote unquote, being a part of that fandom. And right. it's an engagement that you kind of miss out on during seclusion.
Yeah. Like two quick stories about that.
Yeah.
Right? So one thing is like, I learned, in my own kind of, you know, coaching training and just as me as a hobbyist, about, you know, learning about the brain and stuff. We have these things in our brains called mirror neurons. So that's what helps create empathy. So like whenever you see somebody, okay. is this podcast rated PG? I just want to ask this before I ask this, bring up this next point.
Oh no, we are risque.
Okay. You ever, there was a scene in King of the Hill where Bobby Hill was kicking people in the testicles.
Oh,
and I okay. find that hilarious. And I shouldn't, because I know, like,
it hurts.
Right. I'm a person with those parts. And so, it's like, I get it. Right. But it's funny. It's funny as hell for me. But it's the idea that when you see somebody else get injured or somebody else, when you see like a veteran coming home to their dog, to their kid, right, their family, and you start tearing up, right? That's your mirror neurons acting up. So mm-hmm. when you're watching a reactor video to a very big scene, right, you're empathizing with them at the same time. And just sort of bringing this back to my first fandom, right? why the Mandalorian was watching the reactor was such a big deal for me for the Mandalorian was the Mandalorian for many people was the one of the most commonly expressed things was this feels like Star Wars.
Yeah.
In a way that the sequels didn't. Even the prequels didn't. And you know, shout out to, you know, to Dave Filoni and John Favreau, right? As always, right? The new G's. But it did bring me back to that feeling I had when I was a kid watching it. Yeah. Right. And to see the reactors, many reactors express the same thing at the Mandalorian finale, right? Really throughout the entire thing. Was really great, and that's a good. And I will say this: it's a good kind of non-awkward, socially awkward interaction. Because when I did get back out, I don't know, the lockdown did something psychologically to a lot of people. Because I went for a walk. I went to visit my parents, my sister. We went for a walk, and somebody was driving around. I think an Uber Foods driver, okay. wearing one of the Katie Sackhoff's characters, her name slips my mind right now.
Not sure.
Wearing her kind of, you know, Mandalorian helmet, right?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she's from, yeah, I I'm having a brain fart, it's tremendous. He was just walking around wearing that helmet instead of a mask.
Oh my God.
Right. And I felt inclined because I thought I was just so excited to see somebody. Oh, this is embarrassing. I can't believe I'm going to share this. Right. I was so excited to see somebody in the fandom. Right. I actually called out from across a busy parking lot. This is the way. The person looked at me and I don't think they knew what was going on. And then I'm kind of standing there kind of like, come on, say it back.
Right? Do things.
And then they just kind of waved at me quietly. I'm like, oh man, that's kind of embarrassing.
That's not what I wanted.
That's not the reaction I wanted, but that's the type of, that's the type of thing, right? That I miss seeing that in my reality.
Yes.
I used to go to in Toronto, we have Fan Expo every summertime, every August, right? And so it's our version of San Diego Comic-Con.
Right.
So big convention center in Toronto fills up, and I got to meet Gillian Anderson there.
Oh,
I got to
God.
Meet Norman Reedus from The Walking Dead, and right? And William Shatner had given a thing there at one point. Who else? Nathan Fillion from Firefly. Like, you get everyone kind of coming in, right? I go to their live talks, right?
Yeah.
And just walking around and seeing who's dressed up as what and kind of guessing, you know, and I have to say this, every single year I've been there, the Babylon 5 fandom is criminally underrepresented. So there's got to be an opportunity there for the B5ers. But yeah. Anyway, that's just aside from that. Right. Yeah. And that's coming back. I don't think it's coming back this year because we're still kind of climbing out of it. They want to be a bit cautious. But the big events, you know, knock wood, we don't have another crazy... What else is going to happen to us, right? Whatever, you know, barring something else coming
well,
to
we're hoping,
beat our asses into the ground next.
Yeah.
We should have Fan Expo back in 2021, I would hope. 2022.
Wonderful.
And yeah, anyway, that's a whole other thing. Bringing it back. Star Wars. Yes. Star Wars, my first item. Yes.
So when it comes to world building, story building, creating as a whole, mm-hmm. what do you think is kind of like the first step? Or that first thing that needs to be thought about or done or should be kind of the first thing you're thinking about?
The first thing is chaos. It's kind of chaotic moving to order, right? And then going back into chaos. So, that's an off-the-cuff remark.
First thing, but chaos.
Here's what it is. By chaos, I mean you get inspired. Whatever your idea is, it doesn't always come like Tolkien, where it's like a lightning out of a blue sky, right? That's what he said. Doesn't always come like that. It sometimes is a creeping idea that develops over time, yeah. right? And during that kind of formative time, it usually starts out with a what if. It could be like, you know, when artists and authors, they get that question at book signings or whatever. It's like, where do you get your inspiration from? It's like, there's as many answers to that as there are authors, right? Maybe yeah. twice as many. Because it could be that you turn a corner and you see something that kind of strikes you. It could be... Yeah. like Philip K. Dick, somebody delivers medicine to your house and you see lights shining off of their necklace and you get something. That's, he had a mystical experience from that.
Right?
Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah, or it could be you're just bored marking papers like Tolkien, and you come up and you just write a sentence.
Yes,
and then it lays a you know, kind of a seed crystal, right? And so you want to write down your random disconnected thoughts to begin mm-hmm. with. Get it on paper. That handwritten note, whatever it is, napkin or an actual journal page, is the first existence of the story in this world.
Ooh,
right. You want to, if you're into the spiritual stuff, like, you know, me working as a coach, this is usually the water I'm swimming in, right? For better or for worse. And you want to talk about manifesting stuff, right? You want to manifest something into real life, write it down.
Yeah.
Right? The act of writing it down is the birth of the story, right? Now, from there, it grows. So then when you have enough notes, and some people go completely bonkers with this, and they'll have...
Don't even get me started.
Pages and pages, and sometimes they got scrapbooks because they're going yep. through either they're going through magazines and cutting out stuff, or they're just clipping. Wow, you look like you're really being seen. And are you feel seen right now? Is that what it is?
Not exactly magazine clippings, but like yeah. the amount of scrap paper, the smallest yeah. scrap papers that I have of like, if I had just watched a movie or if I had had a conversation with a friend and I have an idea. Yeah. I will, if I'm driving, I will pull over. If I'm walking, you know, I'll go to the side and I will immediately either do a voice note, write it on scrap paper, write it on yes. my phone. I am someone who, if I have an idea for my story and I don't immediately put it down somewhere where I can go back to it, I will forget about it instantly. Yes. And it's a fear of mine.
Yes, this is a good fear to have. This is a, no, it is. Because like, how often are you driving somewhere and it's like a time where you can't write? But the thing is, writing it down immediately is essential because you will forget it. You will yeah. guarantee you're going to forget it. And I say this, like I'm 40 years old. I'm going to turn 41 in October. And I can tell you, I didn't want to believe this, and maybe this isn't true of everybody, but at a certain point in your life, your brain starts not working the way that it should, and neither does your body. Yeah. And now it's like suddenly I walk into a room and I don't know why I'm in this room. And I get an idea, and I think at the time that I get the idea, oh, I'll just write it down later. And it's 30 great. Seconds later, I've forgotten.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
I remember afterwards, like, oh, what was that? And a lot of times, so I'm very kinesthetic, right? I work with how I feel.
Okay.
And if I don't write it down right away, it's like I lose the feeling that generates the word. It's hard. Like, that's how I process it in my brain. It's like there's a feeling, and then I give a word to it, or I give a sentence to it, or a phrase. Sometimes it's dialogue. I write it down. So yeah, so it's good that you have that habit, because that is a very well-founded fear, and that's a fear. If you know what, this is not, the coaches aren't supposed to trade in creating fear, but be afraid.
Yeah. Okay?
Be afraid of losing your idea so much that when you get the ideas, you write it down. You get it down in the world somewhere right away.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Safely, of course. Right?
Safely. Yeah. Be safe. Pull over to the side.
Of course. Pull over first if you're driving. Okay. So once you have that collection of ideas, now the thing becomes, right, how do you sort it? And you can go very kind of like anally retentive focused and take each single thing that you've written and categorize them. That's the long way, but keep in mind that for some people, right, the words are just the anchors of the idea. So right. that you can, as you're skimming them, you don't need to move the words over. You just need to recapture that feeling. So that's kind of the starting point, is your initial inspiration cumulatively expressed in those random notes.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have that, then it becomes the story world. So you're talking about how, you know, in elementary school, you'd get together with your friends, you'd wear the capes, you'd cast spells, right? And you would all get it.
Yeah.
I'm assuming these are Harry Potter spells.
Exactly.
Okay. So the reason you're able to do that is because the Harry Potter world, you know, J.K. Rowling created a world that has its own set of rules that functions so seamlessly.
Amazingly.
Right? We forget that there's underlying plumbing involved, right?
Exactly.
It's like when you drive, it's like you don't notice a water main breaking when you're driving down the road. You forget that there's water running underneath. There's pipes. You don't remember that there's pipes until there's a pipe burst in the wintertime. right? It's like, oh, that's right. Yeah, this is all here. And that's the same thing with story writing. You know that it works when you're unaware of the structure. You're unaware of the underlying plumbing. And Rowling was very good at that because like it had to take place in our world, but it had to function according to metaphors of rules,
right?
That we could recognize as being very similar in our world. So it's like some spells you need to have, you know, you can cast almost any spell, but it'll cost you, right? It'll cost you something. That's one of the first rules in developing magic, right? The Ministry for Magic, you have to explain how there's an entire ministry that could interact with the British government, right?
One because of the coolest things. I mean, I remember one of the biggest questions I had reading book 5 was specifically about how is the ministry working with like the rest of the world and like how, and like not even the magical world, but the non-magical world. And it was this anticipation of when are we going to see that interaction? And one of my favorite chapters, and I think it's either in book 6 or book 7. I think it's book 6. I could be wrong. But it's called The Other Minister. And it talks about, you know, the non-magical minister. And it's so cool.
Because that's where Minister Cornelius Fudge is talking to the British Prime Minister.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And he has his own system to get to the office. He goes by flu powder, but there is a specific port in the other minister's office. And like, I mean, just the seamlessness of that is astounding, because when reading it, at least for me, it was just like, of course he would. This is exactly how they travel by flu powder all the time. We've seen that since the second book. Of course it would be the most seamless form of transportation.
Yeah.
And I mean, it is just fantastic the way that she has just created just that beauty in the story building of creating the non-magical to the magical world. One of my favorite parts of the entire series.
Yes. And I want to acknowledge for those, because JK has been in the news for other reasons. Let's just say that sometimes the things that we create are not as good as we are. Okay. So we're just going to, or are better than we are. That's what it is. We are not as good as some of the things we create. So let's just, elephant in the room for those of you who are thinking about that, right? We're focusing on the work. Okay. So
Harry Potter as art.
As art, yes. As this as a model of how to develop a world that is so relatable, but also so very magical at the same time. That's very like, that takes you out of this one while giving you just enough that you can relate to it that way, right? You can relate it back to where you live.
I will say another kind of magical world that I really enjoy. I'm not sure if you've seen it, but the television show of Merlin is...
I haven't seen it, but I've heard of it, yeah.
It's fantastic. The way that they've created kind of the magic and the rules and the laws that even non-magical people know about magic, are kind of around magic and know that it's there. But we all know in the real world of certain things that are just taboo, that are not done, that are not accepted, that are outlawed. And so to see magic as a whole outlawed due to dark magic, and we get introduced to our main character, who is just the nicest and sweetest and genuinely caring person, who also happens to be magical. Mm-hmm. It's a great story. I mean, it is just a phenomenal plot to go through. If you guys haven't watched Merlin, it's on Netflix. The entire series is on Netflix. Definitely watch it. Also, Hunter Deal and I mentioned Merlin and talk about it pretty heavily in our D&D episode.
It's wonderful. Yeah, I'll have a look. And it's interesting. You say that the character outgrowth, right, where you have somebody who's trained in the evil thing, the band thing, who's actually a good person, right?
Right.
The characterization is an outgrowth of your story world. And here's what I mean by that. When you have gotten your initial idea and you've taken it down, right? And I hasten to add, this is my process, and it's right.
It's not the only one.
There's not the only one, and nor should there be, because we're all different people. You got to find what works for you. Here's what works for me. If this speaks to you, then that's awesome. The idea is that once you have your initial inspiration, you want to take the time to let it congeal a bit.
Yep.
So that you can sort it. So, like, I've got one on the go right now. I don't have a name for the story yet, but it does involve it's work, kind of confidential work for another person who is in that spiritual realm, right? Like the New Age kind of realm, and letting that character kind of develop over time. I said, I'm letting this particular character be intuitive, right?
Yeah.
At some point, though, I'm going to have to invent some rules, because there are orders of magnitude that are very big. I'm talking like, you know, TVA, Loki, like level big, right?
Oh, wow.
And for me to be able to organize that, I need to kind of just get a sense of the person, because with world building, the risk that you have is that you're caught up in all these things that have no relevance to your story.
Exactly.
Right? And the way that you know that you're getting too caught up is where that feeling that you got is gone, because you're too busy figuring out what they ate for breakfast 300 years ago in this one town. Right. And it's like, okay, at that point, it's like, now you've kind of gotten way out of the scope of what's needed for this. Right. But with world building, it kind of starts with the very big to the very small. So it starts fundamentally with the laws of physics in your universe. So going back to Rowling, right? Within a magical universe, you have to assume a universe, and this also applies to Avatar: The Last Airbender, you have to assume that magic is just another way that you can interact. And you have to start with the foundation that there are certain individuals, not others, but certain individuals who have certain abilities to manipulate certain special physical forces that the others can't.
Right.
And when you begin with that rule, it's like, okay, now you spend some time working on that, right? Figuring out what that could look like. So I'm gonna pivot over to Avatar just very quickly, right? Manipulating the four elements, it starts out that way. It was a simple concept, right? Earth, air, fire, water. Some people can manipulate it. And the person who can manipulate all four, there's only one person who can do that, who's the Avatar. And that brings balance to the world.
Right.
And everyone in that world is either, they're either benders or they're non-benders.
Right.
And that organizes, that when you decide that that's the rule you want to follow, that it takes place in a universe, but not our universe, number one, where the physics are different, so that allows for this. Then you can zoom in a bit. You zoom in a little bit. Okay, is this planet Earth? Yes? No? No, it's not, because there's clearly a different map, right? So this is some other planet. They don't even have, they may call it Earth, but it's definitely a different world.
Right.
And the continents are laid out differently. So you want to lay those out as well. The geography is involved. And then you say, okay, well, now you zoom into to the level of people. Okay. So now we start doing that. Okay. Some people can bend fire. Some people can bend air. Some people can bend water, right? What happens to them? They tend to cluster. And you do an origin story for them. In this case, the lion turtles. And right, all these things, you see, but see, look where we've gone so far. I'm going to stop here, because you see where I'm going, right? Eventually you lead to Aang, and you lead to Korra, right?
Yeah.
And what ends up happening is, like, you've gone from, I just realized I'm using gestures on a Zoom call that are not end up on the audio. Just bear with me. You've gone from,
no, it's helpful.
Okay. You've gone from high level conceptual stuff rooted in that feeling of inspiration.
Right.
And now you've done what in my coaching certification we call chunking it down, right? In smaller, more easily digestible chunks to the material, right? Until you do enough of that in different areas that you get to where so you get to specific situations. So when you can define the rules of your world and you can build up your world, you're building up societies before too long. You're building up social orders. You're building up values, and you're building up histories. And based on things that, based on those histories that you've built up and the economics, et cetera, right? You will then end up, that's where you get your plot situations, because certain things are possible in plot that are not, in one particular type of world that are not possible in another.
Right. Right?
Like, okay, so a good example of this, getting out of Avatar for a second, but just as a general point, right? The good example of this was the advent of the cell phone. In a world in a world, right? Like in a world in where a there world. Are cell phones, Kevin McAllister can't be left home alone.
Oh, Kevin.
Right? In a world where there are cell phones, that whole trope of driving around until, you know, the time is running out. James Bond in Octopussy driving back to the base to tell him that there's a bomb cannot happen.
Yeah. Right?
He's going to make a phone call from his car. He's not going to go anywhere near it. They're going to find it. It's going to be gone. Right?
Exactly.
So your plot is very dependent on the world that you've built.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that means that your situations for the story, right? So now we can pivot back to Aang, right? Let's pivot to Harry Potter. Were cell phones around during Harry Potter's time?
No.
Okay. Because that story took place in the early 90s, did it not?
Yeah. But like they just like didn't depict cell phones at all. Not even in like the Muggle universe.
Not in the Muggle universe.
Yeah. It was usually like landlines that were, you know, connected to the wall. You did not see someone with a mobile phone.
Right. So that means that the magical folks were capable of instant communication in a way that the Muggles weren't. The Muggles caught up to them
technology
within like 15 years of that happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just kind of interesting. Would that have changed anything? Because like, can you imagine Ron runs off with his dad's flying car, right? To Surrey. And somebody standing around with a cell phone, guaranteed that's going to end up on Instagram, right? So that type of situation can't happen because, like, that would have made the inquiry at the ministry 10 times worse for his, for his dad, right? These are things that you don't think about, but because it took place in the early 90s, the Muggles don't have that technology, right? So these are things you think about, right? Your plot is an outgrowth of your world.
Yeah.
And in turn, like, simultaneous to that, your characters are an outgrowth of that world too, right?
Yeah.
So you come back to the Avatar world. You have Zuko, who's let's look at Zuko, right? Like he is an outgrowth of that entire Fire Nation social order and everything that's come to pass since. So Aang is also born out of a consequence of the Hundred Years' War. Everyone there
right.
has been touched by this one war.
Yeah.
Right. And. Maybe not Toph Beifong. I don't know how the Beifongs made their money, but they were very wealthy, right? And this is the other thing about fandoms too, just kind of backing up, right? You're not supposed to know everything. It's actually like, that's not a requirement to be in a fandom. It's like,
and like, it's okay to like rewatch and learn new things.
Absolutely.
Like, that's what it's there for.
It's there for that feeling of fun, right? Fandom shouldn't be stressful, right? You shouldn't have, there shouldn't be any gatekeepers where it's like I'm a latecomer. Avatar is my fandom of Avatar as a 39-year-old old ass man, okay?
No.
Started during lockdown.
Yeah.
And I'm immediately talking to people who are still in their 20s and 30s who are like, oh, I watched this in school. It's like, I didn't have that experience, but like a number of them are just like, oh, you're not, there's the little rumblings of like, you're not a true fan. Right. And I get the same thing in the MCU where I have the comic book nerds, I say nerds with respect, right. But they're very like, they were reading comics in school the way that I was, watching Star Wars and Star Trek.
Right. Right?
They knew about Thanos before we got the big reveal, right? At the end of one of the movies.
Yep.
And they're like, why are you surprised at this? Because obviously in issue 3, it's like 338. It's like, okay.
Chill.
I'm happy you read comics, okay? I will not begrudge that of you. But I don't know everything. And I get the sense of discovery. You get lit up. We're enthusiasts. You get lit up by seeing the correspondence between the movies and the comics. I get lit up by discovering something for the first time, right?
I will say something I wanted to talk about before we get too far away from it is you mentioned kind of clustering.
Yeah.
And kind of looking at kind of your universe and then kind of zooming in and in and in.
Yeah.
So when it comes to the book that I am currently creating, which is multiple books, currently a trilogy series, might be expanding to a 5-part series.
Yeah.
I've talked about it a few times on the podcast. If you listen to the episode with Kevin Green and I about our writing process, I talk about it a lot more.
Right.
But the main kind of hub of the story or the entire story is teleportation and kind of through time, space, and dimensions.
Right.
And there's a part where in the boarding school that all of these teleporting children are, there are elimination tests that they have to do. And it's 10 students at one time, and they're all kind of given the same test. And it's not exactly a ranking, but it's more of like a can you do it type of a thing. And so I knew that that was something I wanted to be a part of. But I realized that I think I kind of did it in a backwards way of like becoming super niche into it and then expanding. And so like I had decided what the elimination test was and what each level was, because there are three different ranking levels before graduating. And then I went into, well, if I have it like this, then there have to be different types of teleporters. So I have my object and kind of movement teleporters. I've got my time and space teleporters. And then I have my dimensional teleporters. And then I went larger and thought, okay, if I've got all these different types of teleporters and some of them are graduating, how does the government feel about this?
Yes.
And so then I created this government like structure. And then from there, it was like, okay, how do people outside of the government deal with this? And what are the laws, and how do teleporters and non-teleporters work and intertwine? And then I went out again and was like, how do the other dimensions contact these people? What about in different time fragments? How are we interacting? And for me, that's how it worked.
Yeah.
And I mean, I am someone who gets so fixated on the smallest of details, and then I can expand, and then I can expand more.
Yes.
And very much like what we were talking about before, I don't want people to think that there's only one way of doing it, because there's not. Very much like you said, there are hundreds of thousands of millions of writers and creators. Not one person is going to have the exact same method of doing it.
Of course. Like, and that is amazing that that happened, because what you did, the imagery I got was like, you know, in RPGs like The Legend of Zelda, where you're any of the Zelda games where you're just uncovering the map. It's still black laid out. You can't see anything.
Yes. That's
it's a process of discovery. The chunking down approach, going from the big to the small.
Mm-hmm.
I use that. So when I design my story plumbing course, right, I have a course that, you know, on Thinkific that does this. That was designed with the beginning writer in mind.
Right.
And that's because the biggest thing that I've noticed in novice writers is just trying to turn that chaos into order.
It's
while
a lot.
At the same time keeping the idea. It's a lot. So the chunking down approach is a good starting point for that.
Yeah.
But as you described it, right, in the process of getting it very small in terms of the types of teleporters, the training, the levels of graduation you could have, and then how that impacts everything from the government in this universe to the interactions in the other universes, right, the multiverse.
Yeah.
That's one of those things where when you get to a certain, I'm fresh off the Loki finale, so I'm going to use some jargon, right? That's a nexus point. Right?
Yes.
Where suddenly everything branches out from there, because now it's like you've got consequences for this particular element
exactly.
that are multifaceted.
Yep.
And you do have to map them out, because this is not, these aren't just minor things. This isn't
right.
like, these are butterfly effect, hurricane levels of potential effects.
Yes.
If you don't lay them out for yourself, when you go to write them in the book,
it's going to unravel.
A lot of the writing training that we do is to prevent blockage, mm-hmm. right? J. Michael Straczynski, who's like he's the mastermind behind Babylon 5, Sense8 with the Kowalskis, and
love Sense8.
Yeah, it's like all of them. Did I say Kowalskis? No, Wachowskis, sorry, the Wachowskis.
Gotcha.
Right? With the Wachowskis. He-Man, Masters of the Universe, She-Ra, like all these things, you know, the real Ghostbusters, like from the 1980s.
Yeah.
Right? He's behind all of those, okay? And like Captain Power and the Soldiers of the Future, for those of you who are like super niche, that was one of my defining fandoms here. If you really want to get obscure. Yeah, like he's behind all of those. And he said that he doesn't believe in writer's block. Because he actually wrote the entire five season arc of Babylon 5 single-handedly on schedule every day. It nearly cost him his marriage, mind you, but it I feel like it eventually did. But
yikes.
His whole thing was like he was working to pay the bills, and he was working, and then when he got the show, it's all in his biography called Becoming Superman, which is a great biography for any writer to read, right? Because he's been through some crap, let me tell you. Like, it's really amazing that he did all this while dealing with the other stuff that he talks about. But Joe Straczynski is, he doesn't believe in writer's block because he's able to push through. That is not everyone. That is definitely not everybody.
So, okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. It like he, this is his words, right?
Right, right.
So I want to clarify this, right? This is his words. This is, you will not get this coaching from me because I run into it all the time. And the way that the idea is to minimize it to ensure flow.
Exactly.
Right? And the way that you do that is to have this, by structuring your world, you increase the likelihood of flow because you chunk it down. So
I will say a really great way when it comes to your plumbing method, as well as like, I would call it, I guess I would just kind of call it like my inverted plumbing method in a sense.
Yeah.
Something that I've really grasped from school is I'm someone who loves an outline. I love to be able to visually, as well as like physically, kind of typing out and writing out an outline. It is so beneficial because you can go so in depth with an outline to the tippiest, toppiest point. And if you are someone like me who needs to kind of visually remind myself to stay on track, or if I'm going to, you know, work on another point that I've already kind of mapped out in this outline. Outlines are amazing and they're fantastic and they're a really great way of getting your ideas, like you said, kind of getting your ideas out there to see it, and it's there and looking at it, and I'm a big supporter of outlines.
Yeah, I actually, like the way you described your method, I'd almost call it like a discovery method. Like the imagery, like that Zelda map phenomenon, because as you figure out a particular minutia of it and it leads to that kind of, you know, the Nexus outpouring of different, you know, unintended consequences.
Right.
It's almost like you're dusting, it's like archaeology or paleontology.
Yes.
Like you're there with a brush in like the middle of the Badlands, dusting out something and uncovering something that's been there. Right?
Yes, I agree.
And sometimes where you follow it, it's like, okay, I want it to go this way so I can get to work. But now it's like, hey, what I thought was actually just a claw turns out to be a whole giant alligator tail.
Exactly. Right?
And that's what you run into. And like, that's the type of thing that happens in world building too, right?
Yeah.
So I would say that yours is very much a discovery process.
How exciting.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. But if you really want to have a sense of a place that's lived in, you want to spend some time on description.
Yeah.
And to know what the character is describing. Well, this is the other thing about outlining too, right? In world building, is like sometimes you discover your world. You want to talk about a process of discovery. Sometimes you'll be in the scene writing something and your character sees something that's so cool that you didn't even count on, really just kind of came out of your unconscious, right? From the big whatever in the field or right? That kind of got into your brain. And suddenly it's like, crap, now I got to go back to my world building and I got to find a way. How do I fit this in, right? But 9 times out of 10, that's your unconscious and flow and creative flow. It's going to easily fit into your world, right?
Yeah.
It's not often that you get something in the experience of it where you need to go back and change your rules to incorporate this because it's such an awesome element. I'm so glad I thought this up, right? It's not often that that happens. More when you go, like, I'll give an example. I had two stories for Convergence. I had kind of this Philip K. Dick type story of like two people, like the Adjustment Team, which I hadn't read yet. It's just a big coincidence that it happened, right?
Right.
That way. But or the TVA, right, in the Loki universe, where two soulmates have got to meet, and they have to meet, but they have to make a decision to meet because no one on the outside can force them to take advantage of these universal changes happening around them, right?
Right.
All they can do is kind of set up opportunities. And there was something missing in it. I had wrote a parallel story, like a short story for an English class exercise that I just forgot about. in this dystopian world. And I was like, where does this fit? And then suddenly I just woke up one day. I'm like, I got to put that into this world somehow. Right. That short story is in itself in the same story universe or multiverse. I've got to plug him in and make him a main character.
Interesting.
Like an antagonist in this case. Right. And when I got that idea, I was like, this is awesome. Now there's juice. There's something that was missing. And now it's like, there's something to fight against. In addition to just persuading basically what amounts to people, you know, a lot of talking heads, just kind of getting them together.
Right.
Now there's some real life and death stakes, but I had to go back and change my entire world construct. Right.
Oh God.
And I was like, okay, well, how do I fit this in? But what I found was like on a scale of 1 to 10, integrating the new person was like a 7 out of 10 in terms of ease, because a lot of the basic groundwork had already been laid.
Okay.
But I had the 3% that was tough was just finding a way to make it not contrived.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing with the world building. People will say that if you outline your story too much, you risk contriving it.
I get that.
I get that too. It's the Hollywood thing. It's the Marvel thing. Ugh. Right. I definitely get that. It's like, as much as we love them, many of the accolades that Marvel gets is not necessarily based on the quality of the story. It's based on the acting, or it's exactly. based on the special effects, right?
Yep.
I know that the folks behind Welcome to Night Vale podcast, they created the spinoff thing, and I love Night Vale.
Love it.
But they spent about 5 minutes on a recent episode of one of their other shows, like just casting tremendous shade on the MCU from not being terribly original or really just out there, right? And when you look at it, it's like, I was listening to them, I was just like, oh, I hate you guys. I was like, you know, ready to flip them the bird. And then I thought right. about, whenever I hear something about a fandom I don't like, it's probably because part of it's true and I don't want to admit it. And it is true.
Same.
Marvel has to operate according to those kind of, you know, give the fans what they want without letting them know that that's what they want type of thing.
Exactly.
So avoiding contrivances, when you build your world up organically, right, as organic as possible, then it's like, well, suddenly situations are that, you know, situations that seem contrived, you can kind of see them coming.
Yeah, I agree.
I know I'm talking in the abstract. I'm trying to think of a concrete example.
Well, very much, I am still very much in the heavy process of writing, getting ideas, creating my stories.
Right.
Very often I will be driving. I used to, you know, be at work and sitting and thinking, and I would get these ideas that I thought were really great. So I would start working on them a little bit, you know, in another document, kind of looking at it. And then I'd kind of go back and say, does this need to be in here? Can I fit it in? There was one really big idea that I really liked. And it dealt with the planets, and it dealt with each individual planet harboring its own kind of, kind of like harboring their own way of sustaining Earth. So like one planet dealt with like the creation of food, and kind of transporting that food onto Earth. Another one dealt with like the creation of like nature and evolution. And so it was kind of all like that. So it was all very different. And okay. I don't know how I connected the dots when I first had the idea, but I thought, oh, this would be really cool for the book. Like I'm not sure how it'll work yet, but it'll be really fun. And so I kind of like started breaking it down. And then I really, you know, gave it a week, kind of went back to it, looked at it and realized, oh, this doesn't work for my story at all. Like it would completely change my story. It would then become this highlighted thing outside of everything else that I'm doing. So I ended, instead of scrapping the idea, I put it into kind of like my other folder of like, maybe this could be a different type of a book.
Oh, yes, yes.
It would be wonderful.
Every writer's got to have a parking lot folder.
Yeah, exactly.
You gotta park this idea. You gotta park this idea. Yeah.
I will say, when I realized and kind of decided on the idea for the major plot of my antagonists, which is the government as a whole, and kind of why they are doing what they're doing, it was like everything clicked and everything linked together. And I'm a big I'm a big supporter of, at least for me, when I have an idea that I really like that I want to run with, I talk to specific people about it. Or even I'll talk to, at work, I would talk to random people and be like, hey, like, you know a little bit about my book. What do you think about this idea? And, you know, explain it kind of shallowy. And so based on that, it was like, okay, does it, you know, resonate with my characters? Does it resonate with the actual idea that I have? And it does. And it did. And being able to almost seamlessly put it into my story, it gave me this sense of like, of just relief of like, now I know what my villains are working towards. Now I know, you know, what my protagonists are trying to accomplish and trying to change. And now I can really give this kind of overarching history of how this is going to happen and why, and kind of what are the reasons, or I guess more like what's going to happen if it doesn't work out. And that alone is exciting.
Definitely. It's funny, like thinking about whenever you get an ingredient, like something that doesn't fit, right? That you try to, you want to make it fit. That's kind of like when you're cooking and you're adding a little bit too much oregano. Right. It's like you want it because you know why? And not because it, you know, you think the dish needs it. You just like the feeling of putting it in there.
Exactly.
Right?
Yep.
It's like when you said that, it's like, that's a similar thing. I've run into that too. It's like, there's too many elements to play. Don't over spice it. Right.
Exactly.
Sometimes it's exactly the way that you need it. You just need to leave it the hell alone and you're okay. Yeah. But I think like that's good. It's like the beauty of like that type of experience you described is like, it shows that is a great flow state. That is like your avatar story state where it's just like, right. Everything's going right.
Yes.
Yeah. It's just tremendous. Right.
There was something that I saw on your Instagram, and I might be misquoting you, so definitely let me know.
Okay.
But from what I remember, you had mentioned something about like, I think it was like something along the lines of like, don't start a book unless you know what the ending is going to be.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, I've got a lot to say about that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So for me, and I'll kind of, when I was talking with Kevin Green on our episode, he had mentioned that in the dream that he had about his book, which is Biko and the Thief, he talked about that when he got the idea for the dream, his dream almost laid out the entire thing. I mean,
awesome.
Which to me was like, what the F? I got the smallest snippet of an idea and you get almost the entire story.
Yeah, you get like inspiration envy, right?
Honestly, yes. And but he also mentioned how he does not talk to anyone, tell anyone his stories until he knows almost beginning to end of what it is. Now, for me specifically, I didn't think, and I still kind of don't have the full ending to my books. And I think it's because the ideas that I have and the story that I want to tell is so big and so kind of monumentous that originally it was going to be one book. And then I realized very quickly, that's not going to work. So then I decided three books. And now I'm realizing that my three books are becoming like Harry Potter 7 books. And I'm like, I can't do that to people as a first time writer with a first time book. Like, that's just insane.
Yeah.
So I'm breaking it up even more, but the story is so robust and the story is so entangled that I'm worried that I'm focusing on the beginnings of each of the books and the middles of each of the books. And I haven't fully decided on the endings of everything because I don't know how they're going to intertwine or interlay because I've got different times and different dimensions and people are in different places at different times, but at the same time. And it's very complicated and I'm trying to make it not complicated. And I'm worried that if I settle on an ending, it's not going to give me the freedom to keep that flow of being able to change what is happening.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really, 100% valid concern.
Awesome.
Like, no, it is like, and I mean, again, it's just from my standpoint, right? Yes. Like, everyone's got their own thing, right? Just remember, right? So there's no one way. First, when I said that on Instagram, and I do recall vaguely when it was.
Awesome.
So a few months ago, I think, right?
I remember seeing that and being like, I might hurt someone.
So here's what it is. Here's what it is. That's, again, kind of talking to the beginning writers, right?
Gotcha.
If this is your first rodeo and you want to make sure you don't end up like
Lost,
ugh. Battlestar Galactica, Dexter,
yep.
Game of Thrones, which was really heartbreaking because I never got into the series. And when I saw that it ended badly and everyone was pissed, I didn't want to get into the
Same.
Series.
Same.
Right? And I think recently there's another one that ended poorly. I can't think of it, but
Supernatural ended shitty.
Right. Yeah. Oh. And it's like somebody said, I was ready to get on that 10-year waiting list for episodes. Like, this is going to be my life now.
Yes.
And then I saw the outcry. I was like, okay, well,
maybe
I'm out.
I'm out. Maybe I'm not going to dedicate my life.
Yeah, because this is it, right? The notion of getting into a story, part of it is that you want to know that it's worth your time,
mm-hmm.
right? There's a time investment. My English professor had told me that one of the most depressing things he ever does is walk into a bookstore, right? So in Canada, we have a chain called Chapters and a chain called Indigo, right? The two types of books owned by the same company, right?
Oh.
It's a weird monopoly around the around big box books. But I used to work for Indigo, so I mean, hey, shout out. But,
there you go.
Indigo bookstore is like your kind of Barnes & Noble, right?
Oh, okay. I love Barnes & Noble.
It's almost the exact same format. I'm pretty sure you guys, like most things in the States versus what's in Canada, you guys have it like 10 times as awesome, but you got more stuff to do. I digress. He said that as an English literature enthusiast himself for many years, right? Obviously, he taught the British novel and he taught all these big courses. He said that the idea that his time, especially as he gets older, is limited. What's going to be a good book, right?
Yeah.
And relate, you know, why I said it's good to at least end it is so that you know that it was worth your time, because that's the risk that you take, right? It's like anything you're talking about. It's like you have the courage to try a bad meal. And that doesn't stop people from wanting recommendations when they go into a new place, right?
Exactly.
Your time is on a premium. So the way that you, and plus there's a satisfaction if you're a creator of having the satisfaction that every loose end was tied up. If you don't intend to have, even if you have it set in a multi-story universe, you want to know that this particular adventure had a nice, you know, you tied up the loose ends, and anything that you left open is only because you know that there's a sequel coming.
Exactly.
Right? Where anything that you left open was deliberately left dangling and not by accident.
Right.
And so that's what I meant by that. And I don't say but in this case. And I didn't plan the endings for a couple of my stories because.
Oh.
I knew that I wanted certain outcomes, but in the process of writing, where I got those kind of in-scene inspirations, where I then had to go back and adapt my world building,
right?
Those changed the endings.
Oh,
right. When I had to integrate that more dangerous character, I wanted to give him a redemption arc, like in my book Convergence, right? The antagonist. I wanted to give him a redemption arc because ultimately he was also an outgrowth of the main character, the protagonist, right?
Okay. Yeah.
When I didn't intend for that to happen, which meant that I had to go change my happily ever after ending.
Oh.
Which is okay. But the idea is that you're driving towards a clear resolution, whatever that looks like. Like, this is how I would reframe it, right? Instead of like maybe focusing on the ending, where it's like it's plotted out, this event has to happen, that event has to happen, this character has to do this, this character's dead, whatever, right?
Right.
Have, you know, drive your story towards a clear goal or resolution, right? The resolution can take different forms, but whatever you set up, you want to give the payoff to. Okay. Right. If you take nothing else from any of the writing courses that I offer, or like the writing coaching that I offer, take this, right? Do not set anything up that you do not intend to pay off before the last page. And do not give us a payoff without properly setting it up. This is the day that's not gonna, right? There's a book called How Not to Write a Novel by two literary agents. I forgot their names. Very classic. It's required reading for everybody, I think. How Not to Write a Novel. And the way that they spelled this out was like, they said the chapter was called "But a Meteor Could Land There," right? And it's like, he said, this particular fallacy is called Deus Ex Machina, which is French for, are you effing kidding me? Right? It's like, that's how they phrase it. So case in point, I love Stephen King, and I loved the journey that he took us on in The Stand, but Stephen King was not a guy who plans his endings.
No.
That's how you literally have the hand of God reaching down by the end of it to fix all the problems, right? Sorry, Deus Ex Machina, that's literally Deus Ex Machina that he did, you know, God out of the machine, right? That whole thing. Don't do that. I mean, that's one of the things that ends up happening, because by the time that you don't want to end up 900 pages in, right? As like, I have no idea how to fix this. That's how you get the lost ending. The lost writers didn't know where it was going. At some point, if they did know where it was going, they forgot about it, or they fired that writer or something, right? Oh. I don't know what happened. But it was heartbreaking because they ended up having to circle back. Now, it was a wonderful ending from a character standpoint, because we got to see everybody again. Except that the context, it's one of those things where at the time I watched it, I was like, oh, this isn't so bad. I even blogged about it, you know, on my own personal blog, saying why the lost ending was actually quite nice. But it was one of those things where I'm kind of trying to compensate by focusing on the good.
The positive.
It's like the mom that has that one disappointing child out of like three. So in every conversation, she's like, but look, she's trying to boost the other person up, right? That's kind of what I was doing with the lost ending. The same thing happened with Galactica not all that long after.
Oh no.
And it's like, yeah, you guys really lost it. And then, as if to rub their noses in it, all the Breaking Bad fans, when they did get a good ending, because, you know,
they went so hard.
Like, there's only so much you can, normally I'm not a fan of kicking somebody when they're already down.
Normally.
But after, and I was like a very late adopter to Breaking Bad. I maybe tuned in just a few weeks after those would be stressful weeks. I was working in at a freight brokerage office, and all these, my coworkers tell me about it. And I was like, I got to binge the crap out of this.
Yep. Yep.
Because they're going to spoil the ending for me, because they're talking about how great it was, and I have to leave the lunchroom every time that happens. Right. Right. When that happened, and I saw everyone taking to Twitter to tweet Damon Lindelof to say, this is how you end a series.
Oh, my God.
Right? I was like,
savage.
I never forgot that. And I made a vow that day. And now I'm just making shit up. But like, I made a vow that day, okay? I am never going to do that in my stories.
Right. Never.
Okay? Never going to happen. We are going to have a clear destination. And that, too, is an outgrowth of the plotting, right?
Just right.
Know where it's going. And if, in the midst of writing it, you realize you have to change it, then you change it. But know that that's what you're driving to. Going back to J. Michael Straczynski, he had to have, as a showrunner, that involves a storytelling with actors whose contracts can sometimes change, or something happens where you need to kind of, right? He wrote into every single character a back door, like a trap door.
Oh, interesting.
So in the event that the actor died, or that they got, there's like some creative differences and you have to let them go, or something happened, right? He had a subplot in the background that was laid out in the main arc.
Interesting.
To let to basically swap out one actor for another, so that somebody else can come in and take over that function. So here's how you did that. You think of characters as performing functions. Mm-hmm. So you love the characters, and as Agatha Christie said, you must not be afraid to murder your darlings from time to time. right?
Right.
So if you take the screen, that showrunner's approach and put it into your story, it's like, if this character wasn't performing this function, who would be another one that could? I'm trying to make it concrete. Okay, so in the case of Babylon 5, he had a psy-cop. So these are telepathic police, you know, specialized force okay. of the Earth Alliance government. Psy-cops going around, and they're at various levels, similar to your teleporters, right? They're at various levels of power. So like a P-12 is like a psy-cop, can get into anyone's head.
Gotcha.
Right? They can sense things coming around, right?
Interesting.
And you have to, they're required to take dampening drugs by statute when they're not on duty or when they're in a certain yep. situation, right? For ethics, right? He had a psy-cop played by an actress where something had happened where she got cast in another role after the pilot episode.
What the fuck?
And she's like, well, what am I supposed to do now, right? So he brought in somebody else. He had another background character who he promoted basically to main cast for like a couple of seasons.
Dang.
And then she had another contractual thing. Something happened, right? She wanted to leave or something, right?
What?
So now he had to flip. So then, but it was one of those coincidences where the original actress was suddenly available again. He brought her back to reprise her character, and she ended up writing out the rest of the series, right?
The
lead character of season one was played by an actor named Michael O'Hare, who played, Commander Sinclair, right? Jeffrey Sinclair.
Yes.
And it turned out that, and Straczynski's able to talk about it in his biography now, right? Because enough time had passed.
Right.
He was developing schizophrenia, I think. It was schizophrenia, I believe, right? And it was one of the things they noticed it in, like, behind the scenes stuff where he would say things, or he started saying that the government was after him for stuff. Aww. Right. And so he's like, just from a standpoint of morality, I can't have you on the show.
Yeah.
But you're the lead. You're the captain. Right. You're the head of the station. What do you do? He had a background character named John Sheridan.
Okay.
That he knew was going to come into play at some point. He just elevated him into the role. Wow. And backdoored. And what he did was he knew that the actor had to go into therapy.
Yep.
And then he brought him back for a 3-episode arc to complete the character.
Interesting. Okay.
So you were able to say goodbye, and you were able to say he was gone off doing this, and now he's back for this one last mission, and this is where he ends up. Aww. Right? He gave a great ending. And that's how you kind of have to do it.
Yeah,
right?
I agree.
So your characters will serve different functions, and you have to be willing to do that, which means even within that, the only way that works is if you know where the story's going.
Yeah.
Right. He always knew where Babylon 5 was going to be.
Yeah.
He arced it out for 5 seasons.
Wow.
And, that was going to be it. And he was doing that in the 90s before the anthology format became popular.
Right. Like, that's Babylon fantastic. 5,
Babylon 5 is actually the first TV anthology series.
Oh.
Where it's written like a book, right? You knew the ending was going to be known, and the foreshadowings are organic because you designed the world that way properly, right?
Yep.
And you can watch it again and again and see all these things. It's like, hey, he's hinting at this. Hey, he referenced that person. Hey, we see them later, right?
Yeah.
Because you know where it's going.
Yeah.
And this is especially, there was a time travel element to that too. So, like, if you're writing science fiction, it's especially necessary to have a direction at least. But
I agree.
But, like, so for in your case, right, like looking at yours, you have a multi-story arc going on.
Yeah.
And you may not be clear about the ending. I would say connect with that initial inspiration, right?
Okay.
And this is kind of coachy, right? Like life coachy. I would say ask your unconscious to give you the ending. That simple. Don't get into more details. Just say, ask your unconscious, like, hey, how does my story end? And then let that idea kind of percolate for a bit.
Okay.
And see what comes up, right? It could be an image, a feeling, a bit of dialogue, or a scene in your head, right?
Interesting.
And then you don't need to, it may not make any sense given what you've already built.
Right.
But it might feel right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you can go from there and see if that works for you. And if you end up there, that's great. If you don't end up there, that's okay.
Right.
But as long as you're driving towards something.
Interesting. Okay.
That rolled out of me because, like, the ending thing, I guess it's a real hang up for me, and I didn't really think about that.
No, that's okay. That's okay.
Yeah, that just kind of rolled out. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah.
No, you're good. Something I would love to get your thoughts and ideas about is, and I'm not sure if the way that I'm phrasing it is going to match the way that I describe it. So just bear with me.
Okay.
One of my favorite movies that I watched at pretty young-ish age, I was kind of like mid early teens. It's called The Invention of Lying.
Oh, interesting.
It's a really great movie. Okay. But it's about, I mean, the viewing audience gets put into this world where lying has not been invented yet. And our main character discovers that he can lie and can kind of like get away with it because everyone thinks he's telling the truth. And so as the story goes on, there's a scene where he is with his grandmother and his grandmother is dying and they both know that she's going to die. And she's at a hospital. And so he tells her about what's going to happen, you know, in the afterlife, kind of giving her this, you know, comfortability, as I think kind of a lot of us do.
Of course.
But there is a nurse that overhears him and believes everything that he is saying. And therefore goes on national television and tells everyone that he knows what happens to you when you die.
Right.
So it becomes this kind of like creation of Christianity and like the evolution of the Bible. And he kind of talks as if it's quite funny. He kind of talks as if he is God and he's, you know, kind of like telling people all these things and he has all these hang-ups and struggles and anxiety, and it's great. It's really a really great story. But while we were talking about kind of like world building and creating and kind of understanding your characters, now kind of thinking about it, I would deem that story and that movie as the viewing audience seeing the world being created inside of it and like having the character creating the world. And I guess my question is kind of like, how do you feel about stories or movies or televisions or books where the characters themselves are discovering and creating the world as we are also kind of learning about it?
Yeah, that's the Inception thing, right?
Yes.
The Inception napkin. We create and perceive our world at the same time, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I love it when that happens. I love seeing... There's a movie called Finding Neverland. I haven't seen that, The Invention of Lying. I need to see that. But Finding Neverland, where you can see the creative process behind Peter Pan and everything that kind of led into it. I love seeing those types of inspirations. And that's obviously real life, you know, biography and whatever.
Yeah.
I guess I'm trying to, because it's still you. It's very meta at that point because it's still you. When you the big narcissism / self-awareness piece lately theme in writing is writers about writers, writers writing about writers.
Yes.
Fictional or, and I mean like my main character, two of my main characters were writers in two of my stories, two of my books. And it's like we're now suddenly it's like, okay, so how much of myself do I want to see in this writer or this creator person, right? Is this really... But stories are like a dream in a way. Like you ever, when you have a dream, you know, you think about a dream where you're wandering through a part of town and you're talking to a storekeeper and they tell you, oh, look, the clown is coming around, right? And then the dream turns into a nightmare and you see this clown coming up, right? And then you wake up. I just made that up, right? But the idea is like,
I've never had dreams like that.
I don't know. If I have a dream, like, well, now I probably, hopefully I didn't inception
myself,
right? But now I'm going to have that dream tonight. But the idea is like, when you're within a dream, which part of the dream is you? And if you really think about it, it's everything. Every person that you meet, it's generated in your own brain. Everybody in that dream, every object in that dream is you.
Yeah.
So when you're writing a story, every character is still an outgrowth of you.
Right? Interesting.
The inspiration may have flowed through you, right? So I'll give you an example. In the neurolinguistic coaching that I do, right? The I've recently been trained in. See, a lot of stuff has happened since we first talked, right?
I know.
Yeah. So we have this. There's this sort of principle called perception is projection, and the idea is that whatever experiences and people that you run into in either in real life or even in the things that you tend to notice, basically, the experiences and people you tend to notice are related to whatever kind of cognitive filters you have set up, right? So an example is, like, if you believe you're unlucky, you will not notice opportunities staring you in the face, right? Then you do a coaching with me, and then suddenly everything rewires, and then it's like, oh, look, there's, like, I didn't realize this. This is actually a good thing for me, right? Similarly, you encounter people. You notice how some people, are when they date, they're in the same relationship with, like, five different people, or they're in different relationships with the same person but in five different bodies?
Yes.
They tend to attract that. That's a perception projection thing. So when you're writing a story, every single character there, the things that you want to give them is shaped by your own psychology, your own neurology, your own beliefs, and your own inspiration, right?
Yep.
Even if you believe in inspiration coming in from, like, some big, from the big whatever high above the thing, right?
Right.
Like, it's coming down from above, right? It's filtered through your own brain, which means that when you have a character, like so going back to J.K. Rowling, she saw herself in Hermione Granger more than anything. Hermione Granger is J.K. Rowling's self-perception, right, of herself in the story.
Yeah.
You notice also, too, in some of the, like, in going back to Inception, Elliot Page's character is actually the audience in the story, because Ariadne is ignorant of the way that everything functions. So she's asking the questions that the audience would ask and coming up with the solutions to that, right?
Right.
So, like, so you can maybe have yourself in more character in maybe one character more than others, right?
Yeah.
But that's all you. And
I will say,
I've kind of lost the original thread, but you'd asked me about creating within a world, right? So
mm-hmm.
when that unfolds, it's really like another layer of your own story, kind of.
Yeah.
Like the magic happens. The magical point is when you want your character to do something, mm-hmm. and you're writing the scene, and it's not working.
Oh.
That is kind of like your character looking up from the page saying, what the hell, man? I would never do this, right?
Yeah.
That's when the magic happens. Your story actually has some type of self-awareness to it, right? And that's the beauty of it. It really is, whether it's real life or story or dreams, all these other things, right? They're all kind of, I'm not about to go into simulation theory or anything like that, but, like, it feels like that sometimes. The reason why that idea is so popular is because they all kind of interrelate. They all function in very much the same, a similar way.
Yeah.
Right. So seeing your own creativity unfolding through your characters is really amazing. And I'm actually kind of struggling to think of examples. I know that they exist. Where you could talk about, do you have one in mind where that's happened?
Not that I can think of, no. Yeah. At least nothing that, like, comes to the top of my head.
Okay, I got one. Okay, I got one. I think in How I Met Your Mother.
Oh, God.
I don't know if this was actually from the writer's real life, but it feels like it came out in the story, right? Okay, yeah, this is what it was. Okay. Okay, so they had a whole thing about the real life theory. The characters were discussing the real life theory about the Karate Kid, how Daniel LaRusso is actually the bad guy.
Oh, God.
Right? This is within How I Met Your Mother, right? And it became such a big thing that they made it a plot point to invite the actors.
Yep,
William Zabka and Ralph Macchio to basically guest star, right? And the idea was, like, that actually Johnny Lawrence, right, the antagonist in the Karate Kid, was actually the good guy. And it became a fan favorite because you had all these 80s guys like me. Karate Kid was another one of my early fandoms, right? I think it was either Star Wars and Karate Kid were the two primary ones, right, for me.
Gotcha.
Right? Because I was watching them from such an early age. That at the end of it, Johnny Lawrence and Ralph Macchio were kind of thinking, you know, that would actually make a really great web series. And then they came up with Cobra Kai.
Oh, my God.
So that's the most recent example. I was trying to think of a literary one, but in terms of TV, if it wasn't for that How I Met Your Mother guest spot,
yeah,
within a made up story with made up characters, life show would not have happened because the real life character actors would not have had that conversation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I will say, now that you mention that, there is an episode in Rick and Morty, I think it's in season 3, when Rick is in a simulation kind of in his own mind. And kind of like, you know, the antagonists are trying to get him to give specific information.
Yeah.
And there's a scene where he drives to a McDonald's and he gets the Szechuan sauce. You know, it was like highlighted because it was a whole promotional thing for Mulan. It was back. In real life, because of the intensity of the fandom, McDonald's had a specific day all around the U.S. where they offered that sauce again. Which was like that. Insane.
There was a real life Los Pollos Hermanos that opened up.
And there's a real life Bob's Burgers store that is open and is fully supported by the creators of Bob's Burgers. I mean, insane.
Somebody won the lottery using Hurley's numbers from Lost.
No.
4, 8, 15, 16, 23, 42. They played it and they won. And then actually, because of that, none of their relatives asked them for money. Because they knew bad shit was going to happen to them, right?
That is amazing.
They had to split the winnings because apparently the numbers were so popular that quite a lot of people played the same numbers on the same draw. So they had to split the pot, I think, like 10 different ways. But it's one of those things where it's like, the arc numbers, right, as a trope, when you create kind of repeated arc sayings or arc quotes, and then it goes, if it's very well received by a mass audience, it then becomes a real life thing that then you can allude to. So later on in the TV series Chuck, they had a guest star from somebody from Lost guest starred on it, right?
Oh my God.
And you could see the numbers coming up in the display because Chuck was a really great fandom show, right?
Okay.
It touched on all the other fandoms, right?
Yes.
Because the lead character was a giant nerd and it was great. So they, you know, and so like it becomes the thing now where it was made up and then it kind of generates a thing in reality. It's like the life imitating art thing. Yeah, so
that's amazing.
Definitely does happen, and I'm sure there's other instances like the McRib thing. Apparently, did McDonald's have a McRib until it became this kind of Well, Homer Simpson started eating them.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I don't know.
Oh my God! Wow, I think this is a great time to wrap things up.
Yeah, on the McRib. Yeah, let's do that.
The McRib is a great way to wrap it up. So, what are some fandoms that you currently enjoy that you would recommend to our listeners?
Yeah, quite a few. So I am still in the Avatar universe quite a bit, and Avatar Studios the creators have made it.
Yep.
I want to give a special shout out to Legend of Korra, and this is something, right? From a world building standpoint, it was brilliant. Like, as much as I loved Avatar, to watch them jumpstart the progress of the technology and the bending 70 years, right?
Phenomenal.
Absolutely phenomenal, right? We can argue about the plotting and the character growth for Korra, but the entire arc for Korra was like the idea that a very overconfident young Avatar gets humbled, right? That's the final arc. How they delivered that, you can argue about that, and many have. Frankly, I would love to have a conversation about that without resorting to the misogyny and toxicity that seems to surround it. But that's just me. So that's a big fandom to get into. And if only because we know that there's going to be a proliferation of new series and new stories within that universe. The fan series Legend of Genji, I don't know if you saw that.
I have not.
Oh, wow. Somebody started up a couple of years ago saying, who's the Avatar after Korra? And they took that world even further. So now there's television in that world. There is...
Oh my God.
I think there's the advent of space travel. There's news media, right? Yeah, all that stuff kind of happens in that future Avatar world where there's apparently two competing... One of the Avatars is not real. There's two people claiming to be the Avatar, and one of them is not real. And we don't know who it is.
That's amazing.
The sand benders get their own kind of time in the, to use an expression, their time in the sun, right? Because that one of the avatars is allegedly a sandbender.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And they're considered now a second class citizen within the Earth Federation, which is no longer the Earth Kingdom. And even the Earth, when Prince Wu said he's going to turn it into that, what apparently happened was the Earth Kingdom was always very loosely held together. So now it's an Earth Federation where different regions of the Earth Kingdom are now their own countries within a federation.
Oh God, no! Oh,
it got worse. But in terms of the order, but it's like, man, you know what? Ba Sing Se is like not quite the place to be. There's like nothing good happens in Ba Sing Se. It seems right.
Anyway,
get into that fandom. Get into the Avatar fandom. Get into the Korra fandom. There's going to be more stories coming out of that. So I'm heavy into that right now. I just concluded the most recent MCU series. So literally, I just watched the Loki finale this morning.
Yes.
So I'm very much into that. I am really going old school as well and getting into Naruto.
Yes.
Because I got disrupted by the Loki series where I don't have a lot of time to watch it. So I'm doing that.
Right.
Cobra Kai is coming back. These multi-generational stories, especially, right? If you're an 80s kid. Mm-hmm. Growing up, and you kind of want to see, even with Avatar, it's like you want to see how did the son and grandson of Aang turn out, right? How is it that Zuko was the only parent who didn't mess up their kids somehow? And it makes sense. You want to see, and how's it that Johnny Lawrence, Ralph Macchio starts raising two spoiled rich kids who then have to learn, humility and all these other things, right?
Yep.
These are kind of the things, right? Like multi generational stories.
Yeah.
Very popular in Bollywood cinema, by the way. I don't watch a lot of Bollywood, but apparently it's like the actors who were the young hot things back in the day are now the mommies and daddies and granddaddies, and now they're playing those roles. So people like to see that happening.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Other fandoms. I think those are the main ones for now. It's hard for me to kind of pin down in the moment, but
yeah,
those are the with the limited time that I have to kind of spend watching stuff. Right. I mean, if I'm not watching Hot Ones or reruns of Anthony Bourdain or tank stuff or any of my food stuff, that's usually what I'm into. Right. Like at this point.
Perfect.
I want to get into, I'm just catching up on Attack on Titan. Cause apparently that did end well.
Yes.
Is that true? It did end well.
Yes, very well.
So now, Aaron Yeager just got eaten, and so I know what happens afterwards. So I want to go. That's where I'm at. That's where I left off. It's kind of crazy in my world. There's a lot of that. And get into Studio Ghibli as well. I know it's just to do something good for your heart.
It's so good. The very first Studio Ghibli film I ever saw was Kiki's Delivery Service, and it's still my favorite.
Yeah. Listen, any entrepreneur, right? If you want to open a business or anything, you want to do a side gig and turn it into your main gig, that is a great movie to watch for that. If you're taking a breather from it, but you still want to kind of work on it and let the juices flow in your unconscious while you're having fun, watch Kiki's Delivery Service.
So good. Yeah. Yeah. And if you want to be scarred for life, watch Spirited Away.
I thought you were going to say, I thought you were going to the Grave of the Fireflies. I thought you were going to go there.
No,
I went there. I left part of my soul there. And it's like, I have not bawled at a cartoon like that much.
Spirited Away is freaky enough for me.
Spirited Away was but the imagery though of the train on water,
it's so beautiful.
Yes, into my brain, right?
It's same with Ponyo. I mean, just stunning. Yeah. How beautiful it is.
And what is it? My friend Totoro, where the thing where Totoro turns into the wind. It's like. That touched something. That's like the child in you kind of trying to find out how the world works. So you make it
right.
Right. And then he just turns into the wind and the plants grow. And it's like, I don't know. Oh yeah. It's just, yeah, Studio Ghibli, definitely. Yes. Get into that. Yeah, those are kind of the main ones I'd say for right now.
Yeah.
I could go on, though.
How could our listeners find you?
Right now, so as we kind of said offline at the beginning before we started recording, it's like I do so many things. It's
so
hard,
many.
But at the same time, I have to name like only a few, right? I would say this, the simplest way right now, follow me on Instagram, Jody Aberdeen, okay? I have links to my Anthony Bourdain tribute Instagram page. I have links to my coaching business. So follow me on Instagram there. Look up my story plumbing course because I've alluded to it a few times on Thinkific. So we could put that link in the description as well, maybe.
Totally. Yep.
And I would say start with those. Okay. And that's where I'm putting most of my attention these days. I am launching a new podcast. It's a limited series related to my coaching business called The Millennial Midlife Opportunity.
Okay.
Mostly because people my own age are running into, creative or not, are running into five different crises, of which our midlife crisis is only one, because we got rampant mental health issues, the pandemic effects, massive social upheaval and political upheaval, and the biggest fish, the climate changing, right? We're imagine having a midlife crisis at the same time as you're dealing with four others, right? This is what we're entering into.
Yeah.
Right? So I have a limited series podcast for that. Depending on if I can get it up quickly, I can send you the link for those as well. But those are the I'm going to focus on those for now. Yeah.
Perfect.
This is hard. As you said, we're juggling so many things, right?
Like, I know.
So many things. How do you pick just one? But that's really it. So, yeah.
Jody also has a podcast that has ended. It's called, and let me know if I'm wrong, it's called Ghostwriters and Pups.
Yeah, the Ghostwriter and Pup podcast is like, yeah. I was going to call it Ghostwriter and Son, but I don't have a son. I have a dog, so I call it Ghostwriter.
Dog. Yeah. It's really great. It's on Spotify. There are still lots of really valuable, amazing information on there. Definitely check that out. All of his information will be linked in the description of this episode, as well as go on to letstalkfandomspodcast.com under Jody's guest information. That'll also be highlighted under his actual audio episode. And we'll have more links that are specific to him, specific to this topic. And we'll have articles and documents and PDFs, but it'll also give you specific information to his coaching so that you guys can also be creative like we are.
Thank you so much, Tazita. This is a lot of fun. I'm so glad you had me on. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here with us. It's been a roller coaster finally sitting down and getting to do this, but it has been nothing but a great time having you here and being able to interact with you during the intermission time. I cannot wait to have you back on the podcast. We'll specifically talk about Avatar: The Last Airbender.
Yeah.
And all of the shenanigans that goes on in Korra.
Yeah, definitely. Let me know. I'm so there. Thank you so much. I'd love to be there. Thank you.
Thank you all so much for listening to my very first podcast. Let's Talk Fandoms is produced by Tazita Gant, created by Tazita Gant, edited by Tazita Gant, hosted by Tazita Gant, cover art done by Psych A Relic on Instagram, intro music done by Riri Retro, also on Instagram. You can find all of their links in the description of this podcast on each episode. Remember to keep talking fandoms with us, along with everyone else you know. You can find Let's Talk Fandoms Podcast on Instagram and Fandoms Podcast on Twitter. We would love to hear your feedback by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts and any other place you are able.